You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 275.
On today's show, we talk about a sarcophagus turned beach bar, the altar stone at Stonehenge, and the ever-controversial Homo naledi.
Let's dig a little deeper. And look under your feet. It could be an old Roman artifact. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Good. Tired.
Yeah. Been a long weekend.
It has been a long travel weekend. We're still in Maine. Loving it up here so much. I'm in a sweatshirt right now, and it's August, so that makes me happy.
I wore like a long sleeve all day today.
Yeah.
So we're in our first weekend, I guess, at Acadia National Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're actually physically in the park this time.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we're outside of the park when we say we're at a park, you know, but yeah. I managed to get us a camp spot like in the actual park, although it's on the mainland side, not the island side. Which is great and fine and beautiful over here. So, but it's where the big RV park area is.
When was the last time we were in an RV park in the national park? Was it Zion or was it Glacier?
Probably Zion.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to get into these parks when you're there at the high season. And also like with an RV of our size. So, yeah.
Yeah, but Acadia is really nice because it seems like the park has been pretty well updated.
This side, this particular bit of park, it's called Skudik Peninsula, I think is what it is over here. And this is the Skudik side of the park. This area, this campground has been constructed in the last like 10 years, I think. So it's very much updated compared to a lot of the old ones. Not a lot of tree cover, but like that really works for us when we need Starlink.
We skidicked right into a cancellation.
We did. I have a lot of ways of checking for cancellations and that kind of thing. There's a lot of, this is why we're going to do an RV podcast, because there's a lot that goes into slightly more last minute planning to go to places like this. I wouldn't even say last minute. We knew we were coming here for like 4 months, but 4 months is last minute when people book these campsites out, like, 6 months or even longer sometimes. So anyway,
We'll try to post some of our day on the popular side today, but it was
very foggy.
It was very foggy and very, very misty. Couldn't really see much, but it was still a fun day over there.
Yep.
I think tons and tons of people, despite the weather.
It was still gorgeous. I mean, it was great.
Yeah. So, you know what else is gorgeous? A 1700-year-old coffin sitting at your bar. So
I read this article titled Beach Bar Used as a 1700-year-old Roman Sarcophagus as Table.
Yeah.
Until a tourist noticed. And I'm like, is there a problem here? Like, shouldn't we use really cool sarcophaguses as bars now?
Sarcophagi? I like pluralizing things with an I.
No, I'm kidding. Obviously, like, ancient artifacts should not be used in a social setting like that. But
especially probably burial items.
Yeah, I mean, probably not.
This is a coffin.
It's pretty disrespectful, obviously. Yeah. But in a place in Europe, I mean, the Romans were everywhere and they left things everywhere. So, yeah, but we'll get into it.
Right. So this was reported in the Sacramento Bee and elsewhere, but the one we're linking to is from there. Mm-hmm. But a former law enforcement officer, and it doesn't say who this was. This was in Bulgaria, Varna, Bulgaria. And it doesn't say whether the law enforcement officer was, what nationality he was or anything like that.
Yeah, it doesn't say anything about them.
Really
just
doesn't
that
say.
They were there and they reported it, basically.
Exactly. And so this person's on vacation and they're like, this looks suspiciously like something super old.
Yeah.
So I'm going to report this to the authorities. And I don't even know how you do that in Bulgaria, but they reported it to officials. Mm-hmm. And officials, I'd like to imagine in a place like Bulgaria or somewhere in like Eastern Europe, that you find archaeologists, like there's a team of crack team of archaeologists, like at the ready, you know, and they're just like, archaeologists engage. Right. And they heard about this and they're like, okay, let's get on it.
Yeah.
And they just like descended on this thing. Now, I don't know how long it took between the reporting and mm-hmm. the archaeologist descending, but the article makes it sound like it was like the day, yeah. the same day, but it was right. probably, you know,
probably not. Yeah.
Anyway, archaeologists soon arrived and identified it as a 1700-year-old Roman sarcophagus.
Yeah, soon arrived is like journalists speak, or came at some point after the report.
Right. Could have been a month. Yeah, right. I don't know. Yeah. But anyway, the box is decorated. The sides have carved garlands, flowers, grapes, and several heads of horned ox-like animals. You can see pictures of it.
Yep.
Yeah, there's pretty good pictures in the article.
And there's even a YouTube video from like a promotional video that the hotel did, or the bar did.
Yeah.
And it shows it like right there. It's pretty obvious. So,
and it's in a spot like the first picture you see in the article that we linked to, the bar is kind of gone, and the sarcophagus with a lid on it is basically our table on it.
It's like
basically just sitting on the beach.
Yeah.
But in the promotional video, the bar's basically built up around it. It's sort of a centerpiece. Yeah. Anyway, the lid was missing, the actual original lid, and mm-hmm. it was replaced with a table-like top that doesn't really match the rest.
Yeah, but it looks much more modern in the picture. So, yeah.
It was traced to the Rajana Beach Bar at the beachfront of St. Constantine and Elena, is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And they did some digging, and apparently there's May 2022 Google Maps photo of people sitting around what looks like an ancient sarcophagus mm-hmm. with a bar visible in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the promo video, mm-hmm. and the coffin itself measures about 3 feet by 8 feet by 2.5 feet. It was super heavy, but they got it off the beach anyway, so it's no longer sitting on the beach. And here's some interesting information. In Bulgaria, every object that has archaeological value belongs to the state. Mm-hmm. That's law. That's why archaeologists came and basically took it. So they took it and put it in the archaeological museum in Varna. Now, I don't know if it's on display yet, obviously, but it's probably, you know, in the back and being studied.
So here's the thing, is it's probably not from here. It was probably brought in from somewhere else, right?
Could have been. They don't know.
And they know it's been there for at least 4 years based on the photos and videos and stuff that they were able to find.
Right. Well, it could have been from there. We know the Romans were there.
Well, it does say it was likely brought in from elsewhere.
Like, yeah,
they say that in the article. They don't know for sure. But, I mean, it looks like the kind of thing you find in Rome. Like, this is an expensive sarcophagus, right? Like, you don't find this in the hinterlands. You find this where there are large, complex populations. So that tells me it was probably in a large Roman city, which must at least be closer to Italy, if not Rome, right? Maybe. That's what it seems like.
Not necessarily. They had capitals and things out and around and about. They had larger centers around. I mean, this, you know, 1,700 years ago, who knows though, right?
Sure. I don't know.
I don't know.
What it seems like to me is that the restaurant bar thought it would be cool to have this as the centerpiece, and they didn't really think through the consequences of it.
Yeah.
They got it from somewhere, because they're not talking. They're not saying where it came from, how they got it, or anything like that.
Yeah.
At least not publicly. They probably are to the authorities, but not publicly.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like they got it from elsewhere and brought it in as a showpiece, a focal point, talking point, whatever. That's what it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was a bad choice. That's basically like, it's effectively grave robbing. You know, they didn't take it from the grave, but somebody else did. And that's where it ended up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's entirely likely, too. They could have just bought it on the black market in Bulgaria. You know, they could have had an antiquities dealer.
Yep.
They didn't know what they were getting. They were like, somebody sold it to him as a table.
I don't know. I kind of feel like you kind of know what you're getting.
Maybe.
It doesn't look like a brand. It doesn't look like somebody carved it as a replica of a sarcophagus. It's too old, and it just.
Well, no, but it is just
that way.
It is just stone too, right? And stone is stone, right? So stone, if I carve stone tomorrow and I make it look antique-y, this is kind of one of the things that drew me to this article is people that live in these areas, like Bulgaria is. This area of Bulgaria is on the Black Sea. It borders Greece, North Macedonia, mm-hmm. Romania, Serbia, and Turkey. These people that live in this area, they just grow up with old crap around all over the place, right? And ancient temples and old buildings. And, you know, you drop your shovel in your backyard and you find a 1,000-year-old Roman artifact, right? Or something crazy. And they just kind of get desensitized to it. And not only them, but the people sitting around these tables, they're just like tourists and even locals, and they're seeing all these things. And, you know, it took somebody 4 years to notice and say something and say, oh, I don't think this belongs here.
I don't know. I feel like you're just giving them a little too much credit.
I don't know. I think the bar knew what they were doing.
Yeah. I feel like the bar knew what they were doing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But I also think that they knew they could probably get away with it because people sitting around are just like, you know, not going to notice.
Right, right.
And most people aren't going to notice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also thought, well, they probably knew what they were doing and they're like, oh, this is old. They probably thought nobody was really going to care.
Yeah, probably.
You know?
Probably.
So,
well, they might not have been thinking about the fact that Bulgaria considers every object that has archaeological value a possession of the state, right?
Right.
They probably figured, well, this didn't come from Bulgaria. It came mm-hmm. from somewhere else. So it doesn't belong to the state. It came from somewhere right. else, but it entered Bulgaria. So therefore it became
right.
Bulgarian property.
Yeah.
Apparently. So, yeah.
All right. Well,
shady, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about something else that came from somewhere else. The altar stone. Yeah. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show. Episode 275. And speaking of, like I said, things that came from other places.
Let's go. Centerpieces that came from other places, well, maybe.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Although maybe. Let's find out.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Stonehenge, because Stonehenge is always in the news.
It's not been that much lately, I don't feel like, right?
Yeah, we just don't always talk about it.
Yeah, but this was big news, so we definitely had to talk about news. It.
So this article comes from the Washington Post by William Booth. And you really liked this article.
I did. It was a little bit more like tongue-in-cheek and lighthearted than other articles that are reporting on science are. But I also felt like the science was still really good in it. So it's just like more of an entertaining read than they can be sometimes.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend this article.
Yeah.
It's been reported everywhere, though. So All you have to do is look up Stonehenge and you can find out what we're about to talk about.
Although if you just look up Stonehenge, you're going to find a lot of stuff.
But, yeah, true. Yeah. But this is big news. So
type in Altar Stone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so real quick, Stonehenge, it's in England. It's down like southwest of London, give or take. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's about 5,000 years old.
Yep.
Built by druids, or so they say. Nobody knows.
Yeah, so that part's not true. Don't say that.
You know, it wasn't built by druids. It was built by Merlin.
No,
he floated the stones by magic from Ireland.
Still not true.
That's definitely the theory I'm going
definitely
with.
Definitely not it.
Yeah, so anyway, there's several rings, or at least two big ones, and the altar stone is this stone that's kind of like lying in the ground in the middle.
Yeah.
And it's just been called the altar stone because that's what they called it.
Yeah.
150 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. When they were started really diving into this thing. There's a couple other stones with crazy names. We'll get to them later, but they just call this thing the altar stone. It's not necessarily even an altar. Maybe it was sitting in the middle one day, at one time, just maybe like propped up. And maybe that's why the early Victorians called it the altar stone. Who knows? Maybe they thought it was, but I don't think any modern person that's ever written anything down has ever seen that stone anything but half buried in the ground.
Well, it's like laying over on its side. So right. It's in recumbent position. Basically.
That's what I mean. They've never seen it like in its original glory, so to speak, if it had one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's been that way for 3,000 years.
Yeah, maybe.
Who knows?
Maybe.
Right?
Yeah.
So anyway, the recent research that we're talking about here indicates it came from Scotland. What?
Yeah, I know. And like, that's not just a little bit far away. That's like extremely hugely far away.
Yeah, that's a long ways away.
For Neolithic peoples to have been moving the stone. So, and we have talked about Stonehenge before on this podcast.
Yeah, of course. Like,
a bunch of times, right?
Yeah.
One of the big times we talked about it was a few years back because the blue stones, which are the smaller stones that form one of those. Well, there's like a couple levels of circles in Stonehenge. And the big ones, of course, you see in the pictures. But then the blue stones are like a smaller inner circle. I think there's like two concentric circles of them. And they were found to come from a quarry in Wales, right? So that was the last big news that we got about Stonehenge. And the larger stones are called the Sarsen stones. Those are the big ones with the upright posts and the lintels across the top and all that. So, yeah. And so this altar stone is in the middle of all this, right?
Yeah.
And this is why I'm really recommending this article, because the way that the guy wrote about it was so funny. He said that these names that they gave to these stones, like, you know, 200 years ago or whenever it was, there's another one they called the Slaughter Stone, and there's no evidence it had anything to do with slaughtering or sacrifice or whatever. And from the article, in quotes, these were just the romantic lurid names that the early pearl clutching antiquarians gave the rocks, imagining druids doing their nasty business to appease some unholy deities.
Right.
So like, yeah, like you said, it's just a name that somebody gave it 150 years ago. We don't actually know what it was used for.
Yeah. And like we said, until now, we thought the Ultra Stone was from Wales, just like the Bluestones.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just made an assumption there.
Yeah. So this new study is PhD student Anthony Clark, and he is from Wales, and he led this new research into the Ultra Stone. And they basically examined two examples of the stone. Each one was like thinner than a hair, which is so crazy to me that they can use these tiny, skinny, thin little samples and draw so many conclusions from them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, of course, taking pieces off these stones of Stonehenge is no longer allowed.
Of course.
Yeah.
You can't even like walk up to Stonehenge anymore, right?
Well, not like regular people.
No.
Like, I'm sure researchers can.
Well,
but,
sure. But yeah. Like, yeah, if you go to visit, you're going to be on like this walkway that's like all the way around the outside of it. You can see it on the aerial if you look it up. It's very much a protected place these days.
Yeah, but they do have samples that were taken before these protections were put in place, of course. And one of them is from 1840 and the other is from 1920. Now, I kind of immediately had some red flags about those samples.
Yeah.
Like, how do we know exactly where those samples came from?
They must have very good provenience on it, right? Like, but they know for sure.
What kind of provenience comes from 1840 that's really good?
Well, the one from 1840 is the one that feels a little bit more suspect to me because it's from, like, a personal collection of somebody that was donated, blah, blah, blah.
Even then.
Because back in the day, they used to just, like, walk up and knock off chunks of stone, right? But the one from 1920 is actually pretty good because that one was uncovered during excavations around the Ultra Stone, and they matched it up to where it like fell off of the Ultra Stone. So they know for sure that that piece came from it, and it was buried in the ground until 1920. And then it's been in a scientific setting, a catalog setting since then. So yeah, that one's really good.
British science in 1920 was not super great. They were talking about Piltdown Man. They were getting ready to like...
They could catalog some artifacts in the 1920s, okay?
Yeah, and then put them all together and make a monkey man. That's what the British were doing.
No. No, that one seemed pretty good to me, so...
And then I don't know if I can't remember if this was in the article when I read it, but I'm just reading like your notes. Mm-hmm. You said samples were sent to a cutting edge laboratory. Cutting edge.
They did call it a cutting edge laboratory in the article. Yeah.
They're literally cutting edges over there where they analyzed mineral components, in particular apatite, which is not the desire to eat stone, but it's a type of stone.
Right.
Rutile and zircon.
Mm-hmm.
So these decay at a known rate and can be used as a geological clock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And once they had the mineral composition and the age of those minerals in the sample, they were able to determine with 95% certainty that the Ultra Stone is old red sandstone from the Orcadian Basin in northeast Scotland, like way northeast Scotland, like in between the far northern tip, like up towards where the Shetland Islands are, like way up there, and Inverness, I think. So,
yeah. So, of course, they're wondering... Like, why? And then, of course, how?
Yeah. I mean, those are always the questions. Like, great. We know that this altar stone, the altar stone came from Scotland, but it still doesn't answer any of the questions. And I don't see how we could ever answer the why or the how. Not really.
No.
It's like not going to be possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are the biggest questions, right? Because Stonehenge was, I mean, clearly built... It was built over a long period of time because it wasn't built over just like a summer, right?
No.
Or even a generation necessarily.
Thousands of years.
Yeah, there was lots of pieces put onto it.
Yeah.
And so by many, many cultures, presumably, right? Not just one culture leading itself in from one generation to the next.
Yep.
And people saw a lot of purpose and a lot of, I don't know, intention here, right?
Yeah.
So there was a lot of things going on at this place throughout thousands of years. And it just makes you wonder if either A, you know, people knew they couldn't move it, so they wanted to make their contribution on it, or maybe at some point in time it was seen as such an important place and such a, you know, through time, such a significant place that people would come together there, you know, and they'd say, I want to bring my contribution here, even though it's going to cause us massive amounts of hardship. We're going to bring this piece here and make our contribution. And this is going to solidify our political relationship, you know, something like
it's
that.
Still like, why? Why this spot? Why?
Well, because it already existed. I mean, the first time.
Yeah, I guess it. Yeah.
The first time it was like, why not? Let's build something here.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was like.
It just kept returning to the same place.
Yeah. It's like returning because it's there.
Yeah.
You know?
It became a landmark, essentially, that was easy to send people to.
Grew this lore.
Yeah.
You know, everybody who. This was a relatively small place, England was, right? Yeah. Relatively small island compared to all of Europe. So probably everybody. For thousands of years on this island of England knew about this thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And the other question you can never answer too is it part of the why question is like, who contributed sandstone from Scotland to this, to Stonehenge?
Mm-hmm.
Was it somebody who lived in the area of Stonehenge? And they were sent on a quest to find some special stone.
Like the perfect rock.
Yeah. And that's what they found and they came back with it. Or was it a group of people who were from that part of Scotland who had some kind of affiliation or tie to the people in southern England and that they contributed.
Yeah.
It, you know, like there's so many different reasons why it could have happened. So it's really interesting. And then my other favorite thing, too, is the theories on how they did it, because that's where like people kind of go off the rails with the how theories. Right.
Yeah.
Like I read in like one part of it was like they wrapped it in willow baskets and rolled it. Like that's a lot.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just for this stone. This is for any of the big stones that they were moving from wherever. Like that's a lot. But, you know, dragging it by people and oxen, sure, maybe they might have done that. Rolling it on logs. That one seems to make the most sense to me because you can roll the logs with it, you know, on top of them.
Yeah.
And pushed on sleds. And then, of course, there's the marine transport idea, which we were discussing that. And it seems like it would be both the easiest and the hardest way to do it. So who even knows, like, how these people did it?
Right. Well. Yeah. We'll be talking about Stonehenge probably a little bit on our pop culture discussion in a few episodes.
Oh, we will. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because Apple TV has rebooted. If you don't have Apple TV, find a way to watch this. But Apple TV has rebooted the old,
movie?
What, 1970s, I think, maybe 80s.
Yeah.
Time Bandits movie.
Yeah.
Into a TV series.
Yeah.
Starring, what's her name? Why can't I remember her name? Phoebe from Friends.
Phoebe from Friends, Lisa Kudrow.
Lisa Kudrow, jeez.
Yes, and she's fantastic in it.
Yeah.
But also, like, she's great, but, like, personal favorites of mine, Jemaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords, and Taika Waititi from, like, everything.
Right.
He's amazing. I love everything he does.
Yeah,
so.
They have actually kind of smaller parts in it.
They do, yeah.
But they produced and wrote it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's all their genius behind it.
I love it so much, and we're definitely going to do a pop culture review of it, so.
Because they, I mean, just real quick, so you can go watch it, they got some of the history that we've kind of looked, that we just kind of already knew, and then some of the stuff we've kind of verified.
Yeah.
Shockingly accurate.
They did. Spoiler alert. They go to Woodhenge. Yeah. They don't even talk about Stonehenge in the first episode.
No.
Well, maybe they did. But they definitely started with Woodhenge.
Which is a real thing.
Who even knows what Woodhenge is except for archaeologists? It just like warmed my nerdy heart when that happened. And I was like, I am in. This is my show.
Right.
I love it.
Right. Yep.
Anyway, so pop culture episode coming soon.
Right. So one thing you don't do is you don't tell a bunch of archaeologists something that isn't true and you've done your research. Make sure you've done your research and make sure you've published and make sure you've done all your things and you've crossed all
just
your T's.
Talk to other archaeologists before you publish. That's
you've dotted all your I's.
You know.
Yeah.
You know.
Unlike the people at Rising Star Cave. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 275. And a few, I don't know, months ago, was it months ago or was it last year?
Episode 246.
Episode 246, if I'd only read my notes.
If only you would read the first notes.
A few 30 episodes ago, So episode 246, according to my notes in front of me.
I do know the date because I put that note in, obviously. It was December 21st last year. So it was right at the end of the year.
It was a few months ago. I was right.
Is that a few months? Is 8 months a few?
That's a more than one.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
All right.
So score and 30 episodes ago, we actually it's way fewer than four score.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So
30 episodes.
Approximately 30 episodes ago. Mm-hmm. What are we even talking about right now?
One score and 10 episodes ago.
have no idea what's happening right now.
Okay. So I'm going to probably cut some of this out because it's ridiculous.
No, it's awesome. This is good podcasting content right here.
So last year, like you've been trying to say for 5 minutes, we covered the Unknown Cave of Bones documentary. And we were actually a little bit late on that coverage, I think. It came out a couple months before. So it's probably been out for, you know, almost a year at this point, right? Mm-hmm. And the guy who did the documentary, Lee Berger, it's a real slick, like, Netflix documentary. It's really well presented, had all these beautiful graphics. It was wonderful. And it was all based on research that hadn't been peer reviewed yet. And now we've talked about the peer review process and how there's a lot to be criticized there for sure. But the peers, the peers have revolted over Lee Berger's. Yeah, they have reviewed and they are not happy with Lee Berger's conclusions or not conclusions, even his.
I think his just research.
The results of his research. I mean, the data doesn't lie. The data is there. It's just that the conclusions that he's drawing from that data, other people are not agreeing with. And so this is just another article of people who are not agreeing with him. So now, yeah,
people are notoriously, especially if it's not your research, people are notoriously
skeptical.
I would say not only skeptical, but cautious to upend all of, scientific know-how and reasoning.
Yeah.
And I don't archaeological think
I need
theory.
Yeah. I don't need to quote Carl Sagan here, but you guys know what I'm about to say.
Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Yeah. So to recap, let's go back and
see what we're talking about.
Homo naledi was a human ancestor first found in the Rising Star Cave system in South Africa in 2013. Mm-hmm. Now, if you remember, this was the one where they had to basically recruit a bunch of really tiny archaeologists, basically paleoanthropologists, a lot of which ended up just being women because they're just physically smaller.
Yeah.
So these just like fantastic paleoanthropologist shimmy their way into this tiny ass little cave system. Mm-hmm. Lee Berger himself lost a crap ton of weight just so he could go down there one time. Because he wasn't like a tiny guy.
He did it in the show. So he did it a little bit for like a show stunt.
Well, he also really wanted to go in there, but they happened to be filming.
Happened to be? Call it what it is.
Yeah,
it was a bit of a stunt for the show, but that's fine. Right. I'm not mad at that stunt. It's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, they went down there and they found these remains.
Yeah.
Right. These remains that looked like they had been buried.
Yeah. And they were a new species and it was very exciting. It's beautiful context, you know, like they have pre-human remains are not often complete. Right. Mm-hmm. But they have a lot of skeletons that are like somewhat complete.
Yeah.
Like these remains are just fabulous. That's what caves do for you. Right. They just preserve things so well. So they've been excavating there for, 10 plus years. And last summer, Lee Berger and his associates, they released a series of what's called preprints. And those were announcing that they had found evidence of human burial.
Yeah.
Amongst the Homo naledi remains in this cave. Now, that might not sound crazy because we're talking about buried remains, right?
Yeah.
But this was extremely controversial, not only because it pushes back the earliest evidence of burial by 130,000 years, which is a huge amount of time.
Yeah.
But it was also carried out by a non-human species, which we've never seen that before in any other site or any other human ancestor.
Right.
So those are gigantic claims. It says so much about a species to say that they had the structure, the social structure around death to basically perform a burial for their loved ones. That says so much about the development of the brain. It's huge claims that you need to have big evidence to back up.
Yeah. And the burials that they were talking about date to about 236,000 to 335,000 years ago, which, like you said, is shockingly old.
Yeah. So old.
Yeah. So the immediate response that was published by experts saying that the evidence was incomplete and inadequate and should not be viewed as finalized scholarship. They just think there's more work that needs to be done.
Yeah. More analysis, more work. Yeah. It was kind of a quick, like, knee-jerk clapback that happened almost right away, which I think is what got us on the bandwagon because we saw the response mm-hmm. to the documentary and we're like, oh, wait a minute. This documentary is maybe not so on the up and up. And then, yeah, so it's kind of been a rolling like criticism since that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And another paper recently was published in the journal Paleoanthropology and refutes some of the specifics of the burials. Mm-hmm. Berger's work claims that the remains of the Homo naledi were found in a hard to reach spot in the back of the cave.
True.
Seemingly laid out in an orderly position and placed in shallow dugout pits and covered with soil.
And therein lies the rub.
Right.
Or the problematic information.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So this covered in soil piece makes it look like it's an actual burial.
Yeah.
And people are having a problem with that.
A burial with intention.
Yeah.
Like a person wanted to cover their dead family member or whoever in right. soil to protect them from whatever, like whatever their reasons were, you know? Yeah. So in this new study that was published in the journal Paleoanthropology, the researchers basically carried out a reanalysis of the geochemical and sedimentological data that was presented in Berger's work. And I did go take a look in the article. We linked to an IFL Science article, right? Mm-hmm. In that article, there's a link to the actual peer-reviewed article. And I went and looked at that. Oh boy, it is jargon heavy, very geomorphology focused, blah, blah, blah. But the takeaway I got from it is they have this really great figure in there where they... In one column, they put up Berger's work, where these graphs show that the burials were on purpose. That's what his graph is supposed to show. And then in the middle, they put up the same figures and they reproduced those same figures that Berger created using his numbers and his data. And they sort of walked it back to figure out what variables and constants he was using, because these are math equations, right? This is statistics and math equations. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to know what constants, what variables, what other mathy things he was using to create the graphs that he did. And those graphs that they created, they said were not using consistent methodology for the type of analysis that he was doing.
Yeah.
And then they reran all that data using what they consider to be consistent, constants, mathy stuff for this kind of analysis and came out with different graphs, basically, that don't support burial. So there's your like 5-second summary from somebody who doesn't even have a master's degree.
So make sure you get your mathy stuff right.
Get the mathy stuff right. Well, you have to make choices, right? When you're doing the mathy bits of research, there are choices to be made. You have to pick out certain constants and stuff like that in your formulas, right? You have to. That's part of doing that. But you have to do it following the standard of whatever thing you're doing, you know? And according to these people who are experts in this thing, they said it was not standard.
I think to break all this down, what all this kind of looks like is, while these may have looked and felt like burials and there was soil sitting on top of these these actual remains, is that what archaeologists know when somebody is buried and the soil around them is the soil is put on top of them, even if it's not the soil that was pulled out of that hole.
Yeah.
You know, as long as they are decomposing around that soil and, you know, we're not talking about somebody in a coffin or something like that. We're talking about somebody who's just dumped in a hole and soil is put on top of them. Like I said, even if it's not the soil that was pulled out of that hole, any soil, you leave them there long enough and their own decomposition will change the chemical composition of the soil around them.
It's true.
And it doesn't seem like that's necessarily happened.
It doesn't seem like
the evidence is there to state that that may have happened, right?
Right.
Now, I guess I don't know a whole lot about this chemical composition stuff. And my question would kind of be, well, would any evidence of that kind of like maybe washed away after 230,000 plus years of possible water action and other kinds of things and other kinds of soils falling from the cave and coming in and out?
When they said in that documentary, they were going on and on about the like textural and visual differences of the soil around the burials.
Yeah,
and
they talk about that a lot.
I'm like 250,000 years later.
Right. Right.
Like really?
Yeah.
Like, yes, that might be true, but is it because they moved the soil away 250,000 years ago and then put it back on top of the body? like it could be for so many other reasons, I guess, is my problem with that. And you and I have worked on lots of burials we did earlier in our CRM careers. And yeah, sure, the soil is different around a burial, but the stuff we worked on was like from 100 years ago or maybe even 500 years ago in some cases. So like, I don't know. It just, yes, you have a difference there, but 200,000 years, I don't know if those soil differences translate over that amount of time. So
well, I'd have to wonder too, like if you bury somebody in a cave floor and that cave floor is still being used for another 150,000 years, because apparently these burials cross at least 100,000 years.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then people, at least some people were going in there still, right? After at least one of the burials was there.
Yeah, true.
Right?
True,
so if you buried them presumably deep enough that the soil would, you know, after their body decomposes, the soil then kind of depresses a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then you're probably going to have people walking on that burial again.
Yeah.
So then you're going to have it compacting again.
Yeah.
Okay. So now you've compressed.
Or animals, like large animals too, right?
Well, maybe not large animals. That is a hard place to get to.
Yeah, that's true.
So
that's
probably
true.
Not animals.
Yeah.
But you're going to have people deliberately coming back there, probably walking over these again, because even generations later or 1,000 or 10,000 years later, nobody knows who's buried there.
Right.
Nobody cares. Right. And you're going to have this compaction of soil, even from occasional depression. Presses of a foot, even if it's 1 foot every 1,000 years. When you talk about 100,000 years, that's a lot of feet, you know,
that's true.
You talk about 300,000 years, that's a lot of feet.
Yeah.
And even if it's no feet or just a few feet over 100,000 years and then no feet for 200,000 years, that soil just on its own is going to be compacted and it's going to recompact itself just like the other stuff around it. Now, maybe not as compacted as the original soil around it. So maybe they could tell that a little bit, you know, from that. Oh, this definitely was dug up.
Yeah.
This was not. And, you know, you can see some things. But yeah, it just seems like they jumped the gun on the research a little bit.
It does. And you can tell, too, because in Berger's work, there's a lot of like guessing about what the data could mean, right? Which is fine. Yeah. You can make guesses, but they make guesses in a way that makes it sound like it's probably this.
Yeah.
Whereas what you actually need to do and what the people in this new research did was say that this data does not support this. So it doesn't mean it didn't happen. It doesn't mean that these weren't burials. Honestly, it still does not necessarily mean that.
Sure.
All it means is that the data that they had access to does not support an intentional burial. So different data or data collected in a different way might support it, but they didn't have access to that. So you just have to choose your words really carefully when you're talking about drawing big conclusions like this, because in the end, you can only say, well, this doesn't support doing that, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And it doesn't tell me how it happened.
Right.
Like if it's not this way, then what's the other option? Doesn't say that either. So it's science is kind of maddening in that way sometimes because you don't get the full picture just from like one small study like this. But
What is this? All right. Well, I did just get some data in and it supports this podcast being over.
So have you had enough of talking about statistics and mathy stuff?
I'll never get enough of that, but I have had enough of this day and it's time to go.
I know, I'm so tired too.
All right, see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.